Last night, Michelle was telling part of the story of Angulimala at the end of the talk, and I just wanted to start there, actually. That full story is so powerful, and there's so many layers to it. Just if you remember that he was on a mission to kill a lot of people and take their fingers. Their pinky fingers. Michelle used the term baby fingers, and I just wanted to be clear. They were... Even Angulimala had his limits. His pinky fingers. And he had this incredible transformation, as Michelle described, confronted with the Buddha's presence, his peace. And one of the, I think most important parts of that story is kind of what happens next. He was committed to being a monk and inspired to become liberated, to stop, as the Buddha described, harming other beings. And so he lived as a monk and had those precepts. It's not dissimilar to the precepts we take here on retreat, just kind of amplified and quite a bit. But he found that even as a monk, he was so tormented by his remorse for his past deeds that he had a very hard time concentrating. And so he actually was very frustrated with his meditation practice and this process that we're involved in. And he was persistent. He kept at it and was disheartened quite a bit. And then one day on his alms rounds, where he would, go in through the village at monks and nuns still do this, he walked by a home where a woman was in the process of childbirth and was having a difficult time. And a lot of the family was there, and doctors are there, and healers are there, and everyone was really worried that her life was in danger and that the child's life was in danger. And whatever the conditions were for Angulimala at that point, his own exhaustion, his own aspirations, he was profoundly shaken by this, that it upset him so much, and he felt powerless to do anything about it, to help this woman, to help this child, to help this family. And so he went back to the Buddha and he asked, what can I do? Isn't there anything I can do to help? And the Buddha said, sure. He said, go back there and tell them, my name is Angulimala and I've never harmed another living being. And through the goodness of that, may the goodness of that be a blessing for this child and this mother. And so Angulimala took it in and started to head out. And he just knew he couldn't do it. He had made a commitment to not lying, as we have, right? To carefulness with speech. And he was so viscerally aware of how many beings he had harmed that he went back to the Buddha and he just said, there's no way I can say that. You know what I've done. It's like, I can't lie. And so the Buddha said, okay. He said, go back then to that town, to that village, and say to this family, since entering the holy life, I've never harmed another being. And may the goodness of that be a blessing for this mother, this child. And he said, okay, I can say that. Right? He could connect with that sense of, yes, since I've become a monk, since I've made this commitment, I have been that careful. And that firmness in that sliver of his own goodness. And so he went and went to that village, went to that house, went to the door and was invited inside, and he made this offering with full honesty and wholeheartedness. And it said that right then and there, the baby was born healthy and the mother was healthy, and everyone rejoiced in the goodness of that offering, of that blessing. Still to this day, the Angulimala Sutta is chanted to bring blessings on childbirths in many places. And then from there, from his ability to have this connection with his own goodness, not in denial of all he had done, but to find some entry point into it, it was said that it was from there that he started to find the capacity to meditate, to practice, to explore body and mind like we're doing, with that sense of confidence and connection to his own goodness. And as they say in the suttas, in no time at all, he became one of the arahants. And then he kept living, and he kept going into alms round, into the village, and being a monk, you know, amongst the people. And one of the things that he noticed that wouldn't have needed his incredible sensitivity of perception was when he would go into town, everyone would yell at him. They would throw rocks at him. They'd throw sticks at him and curse him. And he would get the sort of dregs, you know, in his alms bowl. And so he came back to the Buddha at some point, kind of curious about that, you know. And he said, you know, what do you think about that, right? What, it, I have done, you know, I've accomplished this great thing. It's kind of good. And what's going on? And the Buddha said, you know, just because you've become enlightened doesn't mean you don't have to live out the karma of all of your past deeds, right? You still did all that. You know, you still hurt all those people. And this is the impact on your life from that. Bear it, he said. You know, bear it, monk, bear it. And I just... it's partly why we share that story so much, you know, and how moving it is, and how viscerally I think we all can relate to so many parts of that, you know, around our own actions and our remorse around them and our connection to our goodness and our spiritual ambitions and aspirations, and also seeing the ways in which, you know, no matter how much we may accomplish, and we do develop concentration, we develop these beautiful qualities of mind, we still are the inheritors of our actions, you know, and there's pleasant and unpleasant, neutral experiences unfolding each moment, and that we have to bear, you know, that we have to accept the truth of, accept the reality of, accept responsibility in the present moment for how we relate to them. That you can really take in when Michelle was talking about Sayadaw Ulakana, you know, at the end of his life, to say, oh, don't worry, Stephen, I don't have total faith in my kama. Oh, right? Like, what a relief that would feel like. To really feel like just the wholesomeness of your actions, the cleanliness of your actions that you, as far as you can remember, are just like clean. And what isn't, you know, you accept. You accept the weight on your own heart, the weight on your life from the actions that were harmful to others or to ourselves. We don't run from that. We're not afraid of it. We understand that by being the wise, caring, careful recipients of that, we don't reproduce it, right? We don't reproduce more badness for ourselves in the future or for others. And that we're so committed to ethics, to our conduct, to carefulness, to non-harming internally, externally, that you can start to build this momentum of goodness in your life. How powerful that is. One of the reflections that the Buddha would have monks do is this reflection on kama. This idea of, you know, we know that, of course, there's kama, karma has a lot of implications that most of us are going to be, like, you know, unclear of and a little apprehensive of on some level. And that's fine. You know, there's no need to kind of have a clear or solid defined sense of, you know, the things that are beyond our direct experience of understanding. But that's part of what's so powerful about the notions of kama. Really, it just means intention. It's referring to the volitional moment of before action. Action in the mind, action in the body, speech action. And to understand that we are the bearers of the weight of what the quality of that volitional moment is. You don't have to believe in lifetimes. You don't have to believe in anything to have some appreciation of that. Right? Eiken Roshi, a Zen teacher and from Honolulu, said, you know, kama is a leaf falling from a tree. Right? It's just, it's the way of things. It's what leads to what. And so the Buddha would have monks and nuns recite this, of kama I'm constituted. Kama is my inheritance. Kama is the matrix. Kama is my kinsman. Kama is my refuge. Whatever kama I perform, be it good or bad, to that I shall be heir. And so, you know, again, the Buddha really was not, you know, he didn't want people thinking about the long-term picture of karma and trying to figure out the workings of karma in detail. It's considered like one of the imponderables. You think about it too much, your head will crack in six directions and, you know, it'll just be bad. You know, just don't worry about it. But to trust that we can observe the mechanics of it right now in the present moment, right? That we don't need to have a kind of notion, right? A concept of anything beyond to witness this fascinating interaction between mind and body, between mind and mind, between body and body. And how is this unfolding happening? And what is the nature of this unfolding in the present moment? What leads to what? You know, how are we observing it? And of course, we recognize that it's very difficult. We don't have a lot of the training and the tools of how to do that so well. And so, you know, we have our method that we're offering, this approach of like, how do we start to have some chance within this sort of stream of experience, this inundation of current? How do we build this concurrence of attention so that we can watch very closely what's happening? Mind, body, mind, 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 body, body, sound, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, right? Like this like incredible that's happening. There's a great story of this philosopher who was wandering the lands and going to every university and every place of education and trying to gather all of the knowledge he could of the people of all of the directions. And so he would travel and he would study and he, you know, would compile these notes and lug them around and was just gaining this incredible vast body of knowledge that, that humans had come up with. And so on his journeys, he came to a river at some point. And it was a river that was very wide, too hard to cross, and he had all this stuff with him, you know. And he found that there was a ferryman there whose job it was to take people back and forth across the river. And so he, you know, employed his services, and so they loaded up the little boat and started across, you know, paddling across this great river. And at some point, the philosopher asked the ferryman, he said, brother, have you ever studied philosophy? And the ferryman said, no, I never have. He just kept paddling. And he said, oh, that's a shame, you know. you've wasted half of your life. He says, oh, all right. So they keep paddling. And he says, well, tell me this. Have you at least studied mathematics? And he said, no, I never have, actually. You know, and he's like, wow. He's like, wow, you've wasted more than half your life, you know. And he's like, oh, all right. And they're going and going. And then suddenly they hit this place where the currents get really crazy and bad. And, you know, he's trying to navigate, but there had been a lot of rains that season, and so it was more than he expected, and the boat capsized. And the papers all went streaming down the river. And then the ferryman noticed that the philosopher was also going downstream, and he yelled out, he said, brother, have you ever learned to swim? And he said, no, I never have. And he said, oh, you've wasted all your life. That's it. Good night. But that is what we're doing here, right? It's learning to swim. You know, learning to swim in this just these incredible currents and this incredible flood of experience that we've been trained to think about and analyze and have opinions of and fix and do all this incredible stuff that the human mind can do with, right? But we actually haven't, most of us, for most of our lives, haven't actually learned the tools, the training of how to just be in it, how to swim in it, how to actually navigate these waters, this wildness and these currents and these tide pools and these calm places, you know? And it's this, like, it's so essential, you know? It's a tragedy in that way. And yet, here we are, right? We're learning how to swim in this flood of experience and these, you know, six streams that are constantly moving, constantly flowing. And so, of course, you know, we try to start in the most accessible kaya, the body, physical sensations. As we've, you know, instructed, it's like, okay, the sensations of the body, the sensations of the breath, sensations in the hands. Can we start to develop this sense of concurrence, right? Can we be with the current, concurrent, this sense of that there's this constant unfolding in body experience. And moment to moment, it's changing. It's rising and passing out of our control. Can we start to build the attention there? Can we include the other body-based senses? Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting. And then we include Vedana, right? This sense of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And starting to see the way in which, oh, how much the mind is moved by these qualities when something is pleasant or unpleasant, that we can start to get that particular flavor of mental aspect of our experience and how it relates to the physical. And then we start to open to citta nupassana, mind states, thought, all the different aspects of mind that are available, emotion, concept, notion, perception. So we've gone from sort of gross to more refined. These are the four foundations of mindfulness, right? The body, Vedana, Citta, and then Dhammas, which we're starting to get to now, right? The sense of, okay, there's body, there's this feeling tone, there's mind, and then there are different ways of talking about Dhammas in terms of phenomena that may or may not be included in the others, but one is definitely the ways in which these things interact, the way that certain mind states lead to other mind states, or certain relationships between mind and body are developed or observed more clearly. You know, so it's like the way we've been teaching this is there's a method, right? It's like there's a reason why you start where we start, and why we start to introduce more as we go along and give ourselves a little more wherewithal. Of course, not perfect, but there are times where, you know, everyone in here has had moments where it's like, okay, you feel like you can be with it. You're noticing the body, you're noticing the mind, you're noticing, you know, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, you're noticing sound, that there are times where you can see that it's possible, right? You can see that it's possible that the mind can keep up with the natural unfolding of life. And how amazing that is, how powerful that is, how liberating that is to be able to swim, right? To be able to swim in the actual waters that we are living in, that we're born in, that we live in, that we die in. That we're learning to have a relationship with this being in a way that gives us some sense of capacity, of strength, of not having everything just be inevitable, right? But of having the sense of possibility, of change, of being able to make different decisions about our actions, have different forces be motivating us as we go along. And I'd say the most important thing about this last part that we're coming to of where are we bringing mind into what is observed, that is, it's like this big leap, right? You can start to get the sense of, okay, I can watch the sensations in my knee, or I can watch the breath, or, you know, you kind of get the basics of that kind of, you know, capacity and that training. But the idea that you can actually observe the mind, right, that the mind isn't the problem. The mind isn't the thing that's keeping you from mindfulness, right? It's actually that we're building the capacity of mindfulness to include the mind, right? That we can start to fold mental experience into the flow of things that we're observing. And so there, you start to see that there is a this ability to, just in the same way where you think, well, like, okay, in one rising of the breath, there's 10 thoughts, right? That you see that a certain physical sensation is actually full of holes. It's full of other moments of mental experience. Well, similarly, you know, we can get hard on ourselves about, oh, I was lost in thought for 10 minutes. But if you really look at a chain of thoughts, you see that's actually full of holes. There is no 10-minute block of thinking. That does not happen. There's a lot of thinking that's full of holes that are filled with sound and body and emotion and smell and other memories and visual things that we barely notice, right? That actually there's no consistency to thought either, right? And this thing that you feel plagued by, that you just wish would shut up and stop so you could follow the breath, as if the breath mattered, right? It's like, no, actually you start to see that it's not consistent either. There's that every moment of experience there is not so solid that even there it's actually going back to the body, going back to other sense experiences. And this gives us the entry point into starting to have a really transformed relationship to what we experience being as, what we experience ourselves as, what we experience life as, which is to say that there's, as you look more and more closely and you develop this ability to actually see this subtlety, that there's nothing coherent in there at all, right? There isn't a solid anything. There's no consistency to thought or to body or to sound. That what life is this stream of unfolding experience that's not chaotic, but that is actually dependent upon one moment conditioning the next. And so we start to have access to this fourth foundation of mindfulness, of understanding, wow, what is the relationship between mind and body? That you can start to see it at moments, at times, a little more clearly. And, you know, of course, it's not happening all day long, right? That you'll have these, like, glimmers or glimpses or, you know, if we're lucky, a kind of 5-minute window where this dynamic is more clear. But that we are developing the capacity to see that. And that's, like, the thing I trust so much about this practice is we're not making you see something. We're not trying to, like, try seeing this. It's like, just keep looking. Just keep looking. Like that's the instruction ultimately. There's little bits of method, and sometimes we're like, oh, bring a little kindness, or maybe cool out with a little upeka. But essentially, it's like just trying to help you keep seeing more and more clearly. And so you can see that in this clarity, there isn't anything fabricated, right? It's not just something anyone has tricked you into seeing. It's just the way things actually are, and you've honed and made that capacity of mind much more precise. Another way of looking at it is, you know, just this, the normal way of experiencing things, you know, that I heard a cough. That's how we would normally report, like, this moment that just happened, right? And, of course, there is an agreement about what that would mean and how that's understood, and there's a value to that version of the story. And yet, if we looked very closely at how that experience actually unfolded, it would be quite different. There would be a moment of hearing consciousness. There would be a pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling tone in regards to that, perhaps. There would be almost immediate perception of the mind, of what it thinks it's hearing, an analysis. And then there'd be the idea, oh, cough, right? Perhaps there would be an image of what we thought that looked like. Then there would be perhaps an idea of if that was appropriate or not, a judgment, and then a sense of, oh, this person, right? And then the idea of me in regards to that would arise. So it's actually totally the opposite of how we usually describe it, like I heard a cough. But really, it's like there's a sound, then it's called a cough, and then there's me, right? That the sense of me is actually a product of the experience versus the thing that's kind of like producing it. And so, you know, we're not going to see that all the time. It's not, but it's like to start to see that that is one way of experiencing the sense of self, of life, of how this unfolding is. And it's not supposed to say that that is the way we should be experiencing all the time, or that the way we tend to experience it as like me, and I care about myself, and I have a past, and I hopefully have a future, and you know, like those things are also real, right? It's not to say we don't exist. But it's also to say that it's very helpful in a lot of ways to break out of our normal conditioned perception of who we are and who one another are and what life is about, that it provides a liberating quality to that, that we stop, if we don't have the same sense of this me that I need to always be protecting and defending and fighting for and, you know, arguing my points around and getting what I need to feel safe, that's very different, right? Because a lot of those habits will start to fall away. There's a lot of the things around our habitual sense of self that do create a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, a lot of harm for ourselves and others. And so there is a value of starting to kind of get some alternative perspectives on what's happening in this unfolding of mind and body. And it's just through doing what we're doing, but also, you know, just that remembering to that we can keep looking more closely. When we're doing our walking meditation, you know, that's the point of the walking meditation in a lot of ways. That you, going back to that first day, right? It's like, you see the mental impulse to move. It's very subtle. It's very hard to see. But you're definitely more capable of it now than you were however many weeks ago that was, right? It's like there's more sensitivity. There's more ability. And then if you don't see it, it's okay, right? But there's some understanding that, boy, the leg is not going to move without a mental volition to do it. And that's amazing. Right? Like, why should it be that way? Why should there be a relationship between mind and body? But there is. And what is it, right? This curiosity that can kind of, that we have more of a tool set then to actually pursue, and that you lift the foot. And then there's a physical sensation that arises out of that movement. And there's an awareness of that physical sensation, so that the physical act has created a moment of cognition. And then from that cognition, there's another moment of volition, of continuing to move it, or moving it forward, or starting to let it come down. That in each step, there is, you know, uncountable number of moments between mind and body that we can start to have a sensitivity to, an awareness of. There's a great epic poem, story. There are many in Hawaii, but this one of Hi'iaka Ika Poliopele, one of the sisters of Pele, this deity of the volcano, who goes on this long journey on her sister's behalf. And Hi'iaka, she's often referred to, and she says at some point, "The house of the sea, dwelt in by the coral, the house of the coral, dwelt in by the sea. Thus the pattern unfolds." That's Nama Rupa. And so just remembering, it's like that there's aspects of our tradition that are going to look at it in this sort of very technical kind of way. And that there is a value to seeing it in this sort of momentary segments, right? That's going to be the sort of thrust of this way of perception, of viewing, of end of analysis. But it doesn't always have to be like that, right? That there are other metaphors, there are other ways of kind of reflecting on and experiencing. We don't always experience it in terms and in ways that are maybe reflected so clearly in these sort of technical moments. But if you take that in, the house of the sea, dwelt in by the coral, the house of the coral dwelt in by the sea. Thus the pattern unfolds. There are such important ways in which we have to attend to these kind of paradoxes of effort, and there are so many, you know, between love and wisdom, or metta and equanimity, between effort and effortlessness. And I think that, you know, the dance continues between these, between mind and body. And so, you know, as much as we may encourage this sort of lightness of approach and the nimbleness of mind and the agility of mind that's needed in order to be with phenomena as they're arising and passing because it's so quick, you know, that we, of course, we know there's also times where it just feels like a slog. You know, it just feels like work, and you're, whether it's hard or it's dull, or, you know, sometimes you get to a place where even the pleasure is exhausting, you know, where it's like it burns as hot as the pain when you see how the heart clings to it. There's a story of the Buddha on his alms round, going one day to the house of Kasi Bharadvaja, who was working in his field, and it was a big plowing day, and they had all the oxen hooked up to their yokes and these plows, and all the workers were there, and Kasi Bharadvaja was there with them working, and he brought out the meal for his workers for lunchtime. And the Buddha came up and sat and like stood to the side. And the, you know, Kasi Bharadvaja was who are you? Whatever, who are you? You know, I plow, wanderer, and having plowed, I eat. You should plow if you want to eat. And the Buddha's like, I plow. And then they go back and he says, you claim to be a plowman, but we don't see your plowing. Tell us about your plowing so we can understand your plowing. And the Buddha responded, he said, faith is my seed, austerity the rain, wisdom is my yoke and plow, conscience is the pole, mind is the yoke strap, mindfulness my plowshare and goad. Guarded in body, guarded in speech, controlled in food and in belly, I use the truth for weeding. And gentleness is my release. Energy is my beast of burden, carrying one towards security from bondage. It goes ahead without turning back to the place where one does not sorrow. In such a way this plowing is done, which bears the deathless as its fruit. Having plowed with this kind of plowing, one is released from all suffering. And so he was impressed and was offered lunch. But we do in these efforts and these endeavors come upon places that are very hard. You know, this, the kind of other way of talking about the practice of, you know, developing a deepening relationship with the spectrum of mind and body, and to understand that we have very, some places of very deep entanglements of woundedness from life, you know, sometimes from a very young age, sometimes later on in our lives as conditions formed. Sometimes we don't know where they came from, but, you know, usually these places of deeper confusion, of craving, of aversion, of entanglement, sometimes very much in relationship to parts of our body, these karmic knots that we encounter that are very difficult. They seem impervious to our relationship. We try to be mindful of them, and we're consumed with fear or anger, sadness, grief. You know, these places of powerful tenderness that we don't feel like we have the capacity to be with in a healthy way, right? We're trying to be mindful, we're trying to be engaged, we're trying to be tender. We have these tools. And then there are places where the conditions that we encounter overwhelm our capacity, right? Where we don't really have the ability to be with something in a mindful way, that we get swallowed in and pulled into the gravitational force of, and need to be very careful with, very patient with. And so, you know, we've spoken some about that, about just like how actually humblingly distant we often need to get when these types of things come up, right? That actually so much of the work of building intimacy with our lives has to do with trusting how much we actually need to learn how to move away, to give ourselves space, to give ourselves distance, to come to something that's, you know, pleasurable, that gives us some buoyancy of mind when we're encountering these deeper entanglements, so that we can feel safe and get strong again and build that capacity to move in to the harder places when we feel strong. And then to be careful about our big agenda with it, and just moving in a little bit and then moving back away. There's, for a number of years now, I've been learning how to carve wooden spoons. And it's been something just, you know, super meaningful and kind of very wholesome feeling for me, and fun. And I've started kind of learning how to teach it and share it a little more. And Pari and Darine have been my new disciples in spoon carving this week. So we've been, you know, using some birch that I got up in Vermont when I was teaching a course up there a couple weeks ago. And it's just like, it's so much fun. It's so much fun to do together and to sort of see the progress and to, you know, understand this material. And that, you know, even with this sort of, you know, you don't, like, just like our practice, you know, we don't start with the hardest material. I tried teaching a class last year in California, and the only wood they had was madrone, which is like this gorgeous wood out on the West Coast, but it's like iron. You know, and it was like the worst thing to try to teach people on. You know, it's like people already feel scared of these tools, these knives, these crooked knives and straight knives, and we already feel so incapable of like creating something with our hands. So many of us have lost that capacity. And so you want to start with something that's like manageable, that you actually could make a spoon with, you know. And so this birch that we have is like much, much more workable, and you know, you work with the grain and just take off little chips, you know, and slowly, slowly you sort of start to understand this relationship between the material and the tool to make something beautiful. But every so often in any piece of wood, you will encounter a more complicated grain, you know, a place where something happened to the tree, where it was wounded, and you'll see that, you know, the grain gets sort of different and beautiful, actually, right? When you can work it, when you can sort of be careful around it and make something out of it. But also it's delicate and it's fragile and it tends to be very dense. Last year, just before coming here, I was up in Vermont where I learned, and the guy who taught me, he gave me this burl from a tree, a cherry tree. And that's what a burl is, basically. It's a place where the tree has been wounded, where it's had a disease or some infection, and so it has built these layers of kind of contorted grain around it. And they're just so hard to work with, right? The grain is so twisted and gnarled, and they're so dense, and they're, you know, just, you just think about for ourselves these places of our wounds and what is the kind of scar tissue emotionally and maybe physically that develops around it. And yet these burls are like very highly prized by woodworkers, right? Because there's an understanding that if you can work it and if you take the time and the patience and the care to actually carve it out, that they're the most beautiful thing. Right, the grain is gorgeous, and there's something about the sort of wildness of it that's so worthy of drawing out of it. And so I had this burl for literally a year, you know, of like, I wasn't working on it every day. I couldn't. It would have really driven me crazy, you know, but it was like I'd have it soaking and carrying it around with me to all the places I go, this like weird thing, you know, that customs, you know, I'm sure always are like, I don't know, but they let me through. And it wasn't until, you know, a few months ago that I really finally finished this. And it was just a very powerful lesson for me of patience, of frustration, of tenderness, and of determination, right, that it takes, and being able to just keep working at it day after day and feeling like you're making no progress. You know, there are times where, like, you wouldn't make the shavings would be just dust, you know. And the faith that at some, you know, that you have the capacity, that you have the tools, and how much I would need to put it down for, you know, a month at a time. Or it's just like to get some distance from something that had started to entangle me. And that yet how beautiful, you know, it really was in the end. And so that we have these places in our hearts that are very similar, you know, that like, you know, we want to be free from them. You know, once we start to recognize them, it's like, oh, that we just feel like these are the things we want to get rid of. These are the parts of ourselves that if they weren't for them, we would be the people we want to be, you know. And it's like, it's so painful. It's so poignant. You know, can we start to appreciate that we're not going to get rid of them? But that we can start to build a relationship with them slowly, little by little, right? That's interested, that's dedicated, that's caring, that's patient, and that also knows how to move away, when and how to put it down, and just leave it for periods of time, knowing when we can't deal with it, you know, when we just like actually can't show up for it. I was just back up in Vermont last week, and we found this other part of a cherry tree that had this, it wasn't exactly a burl, but it was the grain, there was a wound in it, and it was, the tree had grown in this funny way, and you could see that this part of it was just going to be gorgeous, right, the grain. And so there was a young guy there who is like an incredible spoon carver, and I was like, oh, do you want, you know, we can split this and have it. And he just looked at me, and he's like, I don't have time for a nervous breakdown right now, you know? You take it, right? It's like, oh, great, okay. But that sense of like, can we really appreciate actually these, you know, what we're taking on and the intensity of it and the beauty of it? And to not like just banish these parts of ourselves, to really understand that it's through this understanding, it's through this slow building relationship of carefulness that actually we create something so beautiful, right? That through your understanding of your own grief and your own pain, and your own longings, worries, fears, you know, whatever it is, that you get to this place where you see that it isn't personal, it actually isn't yours, that these are things that we all share, that the human heart heals wounds comes to adapt in ways that actually your own healing, your own process will be of great fruit to others, you know, not just to yourself. That there's a beauty that emanates, right, when you have worked through some of these things, or not even worked through them, but you have a relationship with them that is interested, that's kind, that doesn't banish them, right, that is engaged with them, that is involved with them in a process. Otherwise, we just banish them, right? We dissociate, we keep them at bay, we try to suppress them, we try not to deal with them, we try to ignore them, we try to deny them, we try to just overcome them. And in this way, you know, we miss out on this beautiful opportunity for learning, for deepening, for understanding the nature of the mind and heart, the nature of the body, the nature of how these things interplay and are interwoven in such complicated grain. I'll end with a poem. By Laura Olive Sacton, who was an intern at this place that I learned to carve spoons and these wooden bowls. It's called Prayer for a Wooden Bowl. Here is a prayer for the days that sing, for ancient throaty songs, songs that move across the hill, linger on the milkweed blossoms, songs that open and open and open your heart and the sky and the shape of each tree. Here is a prayer for this song, this one, this evening's rain-washed song, the way the sunlight unfolds in the tall grasses, how the movement of the clouds releases language. Here's to the shape of this hill, its bedrock, its dirt bone sorrow, its song high joy. Here is a prayer for evening, for this evening and its scent, for the sweep of this valley, this one, and the lights flashing yellow, breathing home into the darkness. Here's a prayer for hands. Here's to slicing an onion, thin and sweet and silver. Here's to yeast and flour kneaded into bread, bread that sustains, bread that sings. Here's a prayer for stillness, in bread, in wind, in the deep well of our hearts. This clear heart water spilling down the hill. Here's a prayer for a meal. Dirt and sunlight, swallows in the eaves, the round mouth of one wooden bowl, full of golden beets, deep greens, one red tomato, a harvest made sacred by the wonder with which we eat. Here's a prayer for what can fill a wooden bowl, for what I can hold with my two hands, a handful of dirt, the red weight of one apple, a tapering zucchini, a cottonwood leaf. A wooden bowl will hold only so many carrots and peppers, so much deep purple eggplant, a steadying broth. But it will hold as much wonder as you have, as much hard, sun-toughened gratitude as you're willing to give. You can fill a wooden bowl to infinity with forgiveness, with memory, with song and silence and story. So here is a prayer for what we each can touch with our hands, for what we choose to put into our bowls. Here's a prayer for solid things that hold us to this earth, onions, apples, tears. A wooden bowl filled with our own specific love, with our awe and exhaustion, our breath, our thanks, as well as our grief, our joy, our memory. A wooden bowl filled with this day's song. a bowl of utterance. So may each of your wooden bowls of heart, of longing, be filled with awe and interest and wonder and silence, solitude. And sit for a minute. So we have some time for walking.